Chapter 53. Maria Luisa reflecting, my wish is what my duty bids me wish. Where a wide empire's welfare is in poise, that welfare must be pondered, not my will. I ask of you, then, Chancellor Metternich, straightway to beg the Emperor my father, that he fulfill his duty to the realm, and quite subordinate thereto all thought of how it personally impinge on me. A slight noise, as of something falling, is heard in the room. They glance momentarily, and see that a small enamel portrait of Marie Antoinette, which was standing on a console table, has slipped down on its face.
Spirit of the years, what mischief's this? The will must have its way. Spirit sinister, perhaps earth shivered at the lady's say? Shade of the earth, I own here too. When France and Austria wed, my echoes are men's groans, my dues are red, so I have reason for a passing dread.
Metternich, right nobly phrased, Archduchess, wisely too. I will acquaint your sire the Emperor with these your views. He waits them anxiously. Going.
Maria Luisa, let me go first. It much confuses me to think, but I would fain let thinking be.
She goes out trembling. Enter Francis by another door.
Metternich, I was about to seek your majesty. The good Archduchess luminously holds that in this weighty question you regard the empire. Best for it is best for her.
Francis, moved, my daughter's views thereon do not surprise me. She is too staunch to pit a private whim against the fortunes of a commonwealth. During your speech with her, I have taken thought to shape decision sagely. An assent would yield the empire many years of peace, and leave me scope, to heal those still green sores which linger from our late unhappy moils. Therefore, my daughter not being disinclined, I know no basis for a negative. Send, then, a courier prompt to Paris. Say the offer made for the Archduchess's hand I do accept with this defined reserve, that no condition, treaty, bond, attached to such alliance, save the tie itself. There are some sacrifices whose grave rights no bargain must contaminate. This is one, this personal gift of a beloved child.
Metternich, leaving, I'll see to it this hour, your majesty, and cant the words in keeping with your wish. To himself as he goes.
Decently done. He slipped out, Acrophis, and scarce could hide his heartache for his girl. Well ached it. But when these things have to be, it is as well to breast them stoically.
Exit Metternich. The clouds draw over. Scene IV, London. A club in Street James Street, a winter midnight.
Two members are conversing by the fire, and others are seen lolling in the background, some of them snoring.
First member, I learned from a private letter that it was carried out in the Emperor's cabinet at the Tuileries just off the throne room, where they all assembled in the evening, bony and the wife of his bosom in pure white muslin from head to foot, they say, the kings and queens of Holland, Westphalia, and Naples, the Princess Pauline, and one or two more, the officials present being Cambaciers the Chancellor, and Count Renaud. Quite a small party. It was over in minutes, short and sweet, like a donkey's gallop.
Second member, anything but sweet for her. How did she stand it?
First member, serenely, I believe, while the Emperor was making his speech renouncing her, but when it came to her turn to say she renounced him, she began sobbing mightily, and was so completely choked up, that she couldn't get out a word.
Second member, poor old dame. I pity her, by God. Though as he had a rattling good spell while it lasted.
First member, they say he was a bit upset too, at sight of her tears, but I dare vow that was put on. Fancy Boney caring a curse what a woman feels. As he had learned her speech by heart, but that did not help her.
Renaud had to finish it for her, the ditch that overturned her being where she was made to say, that she no longer preserved any hope of having children, and that she was pleased to show her attachment, by enabling him to obtain them by another woman. She was led off fainting. A turning of the tables, considering how madly jealous she used to make him by her flirtations.
Enter a third member.
Second member, how is the debate going? Still braying the government in a mortar?
Third member, they are. The one thing everybody admits. Young Peel has made a wonderful first speech in seconding the address. There has been nothing like it since Pitt. He spoke rousingly of Austria's misfortunes, went on about Spain, of course, showing that we must still go on supporting her, winding up with a brilliant peroration about what were the words, the fiery eyes of the British soldier. Oh, well. It was all learned beforehand, of course. Second member, I wish I had gone down. But the wind soon blew the other way. Third member, then Gower rapped out his amendment. That was good too, by God. Second member, well, the war must go on. And that being the general conviction this censure, and that censure are only so many blank cartridges. Third member, blank? Damn me, were they. Gower's was a palpable hit, when he said that Parliament had placed unheard of resources in the hands of the ministers last year, to make this year's results to the country worse than if they had been afforded no resources at all. Every single enterprise of theirs had been a beggarly failure. Second member, anybody could have said it. Come to that. Third member, yes, because it is so true. However, when he began to lay on with such rhetoric as, the treasures of the nation lavished in wasteful thoughtlessness, thousands of our troops sacrificed wantonly in pestilential swamps of Walcheren, and gave the details we know so well, ministers wriggled a good one, though it was no news to them. Castlery kept on starting forward, as if he were going to jump up and interrupt, taking the strictures entirely as a personal affront. Enter a fourth member. Several members, who's speaking now? Fourth member, I don't know. I have heard nobody later than Ward. Second member, the fact is that, as Whitbread said to me today, the materials for condemnation are so prodigious, that we can scarce marshal them into argument. We are just able to pour them out one upon t'other. Third member, Ward said, with the blandest air in the world, censure? Do His Majesty's ministers expect censure? Not a bit. They are going about asking in tremulous tones, if anybody has heard, when their impeachment is going to begin. Several members, ha ha ha. Third member, then he made another point. After enumerating our frightful failures Spain, Walcheren, and the rest he said, "Our ministers have not failed in everything. No. In one thing they have been strikingly successful. They have been successful in their attack upon Copenhagen, because it was directed against an ally. Mighty fine, wasn't it?" Second member, how did Castlery stomach that? Third member, he replied then. Donning his air of injured innocence, he proved the honesty of his intentions, no doubt truly enough. But when he came to Walcheren, nothing could be done. The case was hopeless, and he knew it, and foundered. However, at the division, when he saw what a majority was going out on his side, he was as frisky as a child. Canning's speech was grave, with bits of shiny ornament stuck on like the brass nails on a coffin, Sheridan says. Fifth and sixth members stagger in, arm and arm. Fifth member, the vision is majority of 96 against government, I mean against us. Which is it, hey? To his companion. Sixth member, damn majority of damn 96 against damn amendment. They sink down on a sofa. Second member, gad, I didn't expect the figure would have been quite so high. Third member, the one conviction is that the war in the peninsula is to go on, and as we are all agreed upon that, what the hell does it matter what their majority was? Enter Sheridan. They all look inquiringly. Sheridan, have ye heard the latest? Second member, 96 against us. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.